After Iraq invaded Kuwait, President George Bush said our jobs, our own freedom, and the freedom of friendly countries around the world would all suffer if control of the world's great oil reserves fell into the hands of Saddam Hussein. Oil was behind Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, and oil is one of the reasons there will soon be 400,000 U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia. My guest Daniel Juergen has written a history of oil politics and oil money called The Prize. Juergen is also co-author of the bestseller Energy Future, a report of the energy project at the Harvard Business School, and Shattered Peace, a history of the origins of the Cold War. He's president of the international consulting firm Cambridge Energy Research Associates. Daniel Juergen says the current tensions in the Gulf have their origins in the period after World War I, when the colonial powers carved out new countries and new borders in the Middle East.
There was an acute need to redraw the map because the Ottoman Empire, rickety as it was, finally collapsed with the First World War. And there's a big question of what was going to become of these various territories. And of course, it was a time when the notion of nation states and nationalism had become much more powerful. And so the Middle East was divided into a series of different states. Some of it was quite arbitrary. What is called modern Iraq was really three rather disparate provinces, eastern provinces of the Turkish Empire, that had very little to do with each other. And yet there was a strong effort to create and forge a nation and to create something called Iraqi nationalism. Now, one of the factors involved in the drawing of the map was oil. It wasn't the only factor by any means. But coming out of the First World War, where oil had played a larger role than anybody had expected, countries were really focused on oil as a strategic resource as we see it today. I mean, the people had gone to war thinking it would be a war of trains and a war with horses, and it turned out to be a motorized battlefield. And there had been a shortage in the latter part of the war. So Britain in particular was very keen to, among other things, assure itself some kind of access to oil supplies so it wouldn't be vulnerable in the future, and it looked to do so in the mandate of what became Iraq. And so there was a squabble between the French and the British over the boundaries and of creating Syria and creating Iraq. But in the current context, it's interesting that to see and read mistakes of history as this Gulf crisis now unfolds before our eyes, because people say the boundaries of Kuwait were drawn, as I read in one recent magazine article, with the whiff of oil in the air. There was an expectation there would be oil in the northern part of Iraq, near where, really in the area where the Kurds live. But it was the general view was that there was not going to be oil in Kuwait or Saudi Arabia. All the best geologists said that there was not any prospect of oil there. And there was really one besotted New Zealander, a major in the British Army during the war, who was convinced that there was, and he promoted the oil over a period of 10 years.
You say that the Gulf became especially important for oil when Russia, which is a very large supplier of oil, was closed off by the revolution.
Yes, well, then both... You know, most people don't know this, but that the Russian oil industry was dominated by two families, the Rothschilds from Paris and the Nobel families from Stockholm. And they, in the Russian oil industry, was, along with the United States, the major world source for petroleum up until the First World War. Then came the Bolshevik Revolution and, of course, the Civil War and then the nationalization. And Standard Oil of New Jersey and Royal Dutch Shell bought out the interests of the Nobels and the Rothschild family and thought that, well, the Bolsheviks would be cleared in 6 months. They weren't cleared in 6 months. It took 70 years, as we've seen in the last year, for that to happen. But the loss of Russian oil, which had been such an important source, combined with the experience of World War I, gave a great impetus to what was called the global oil hunt. And for instance, the U.S. State Department really pushed the American companies to go overseas and seek new sources of oil because of this feared shortage. For instance, that's why Venezuela was opened up. But the really interesting thing is that except for this New Zealander, Major Holmes, who had heard about oil while he was buying beef in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia, nobody thought that there would be oil in Kuwait or Saudi Arabia. And it was considered wildcatting on a colossal scale.
Well, it wasn't until 1935 that Kuwait actually became an oil-producing country.
Yeah, actually, it was the first the oil concession for Kuwait was finally granted at the end of 1934 to a joint venture of Gulf Oil and what became British Petroleum. But it took another 3 years, really, in fact, until February 1938, when the real discovery was made. And it was a month later, the discovery was made in Saudi Arabia, and people started to realize that there was a constellation of oil fields and of resources of the sort that had never been seen anywhere else in the world.
Let's get back to a minute to something we were talking about a little earlier. Let's get back to how the map was redrawn after the First World War in the Middle East. You described how the boundaries of Iraq were formed. What about Saudi Arabia, which is one of our allies in the Gulf crisis now, another key player in all of oil politics?
Saudi Arabia was a different thing. It had been a second restoration of the Al Saud family had occurred as a result of a warrior king, Ibn Saud, the father of the present king, in fact, the father of the last several kings, who fathered about 40 children, 40 sons altogether, who had started off in 1902 to retake the family kingdom, which they had been thrown out and were living in exile in Kuwait. And with the backing of the Al Sabah family, Ibn Saud set off on a program of conquest to regain Arabia. And by the 1920s, he had regained just about all of it, of what is modern Saudi Arabia. He had battled the family of the present King Hussein of Jordan. And that, by the way, that old battle, that ancient battle, comes up in the present discussions of the Gulf, where for a time there was a suspicion that Saddam Hussein had promised King Hussein of Jordan that he could get Saudi Arabia back and be put back as King of Saudi Arabia by a victorious Iraq. This was a kind of rumors that were floating around. So these ancient battles that seem long ago actually have very current and significance. But Ibn Saud reestablished the kingdom. It was very much a stern, fundamentalist Islamic state, very much closed off to the outside world. But Ibn Saud ran into a financial problem. The country's main source of revenues were the pilgrims who came to Mecca as part of their religion. And with the Great Depression of the early 1930s, of course, the pilgrimage collapsed because people just didn't have the money to come. And Ibn Saud really was in a desperate state. He needed money. He needed money not only for a modernization program he had embarked on in his kingdom and radio systems and importing cars and so forth, but he needed money to subsidize all these different tribes, which he tied to himself both through intermarriage and also through by providing them with subsidies. And he had a British advisor, a sort of renegade Englishman, some called him an arch humbug, Sijon Philby, who was the father of the famous British spy Kim Philby, who spied on behalf of the Soviet Union. And Sijon Philby told this despondent king that there was the possibility of buried treasure in his kingdom. And Ibn Saud didn't think there was oil, but he thought he would like to have people come and spend money looking for oil because he would get the revenues and they would leave and his kingdom wouldn't be upset. What he actually hoped they would find was water. They didn't find water, but Chevron, as it's now called, geologists from Standard Oil of New Jersey and lawyers, showed up willing to wildcat in Saudi Arabia because oil had been discovered on the neighboring island of Bahrain. And after a long negotiation in which Sijon Philby, or Jack Philby as he was known, or as Ibn Saud called him, Abdullah Philby after his conversion to Islam, played a role of a triple spy, just like his son was a double spy, but really acted as a sorcerer's apprentice, bringing Standard Oil of California into Saudi Arabia and launching them on the exploration that would change the world of oil and change much else in the world as well.
When oil companies from Europe and America started looking for oil in the Middle East. What were the relationships like early on between the oil companies and the country that the oil wells were located in?
The companies tended to be enclaves of the modern world in the middle of traditional societies. They had concessions, which meant that they would own the oil that they would discover. The companies were usually the targets of criticism from either local nationalists or fundamentalists. The companies thought they were taking great risk and were providing a service by creating wealth where there wasn't any in the country. But there was always constant tension right from the beginning between the countries and the companies over who would get the proceeds and the real benefits of the oil that might be discovered.
What kind of monetary deals were negotiated? What percentage went to the oil company? What percentage was kept by the country?
The companies would pay a royalty, 4 shillings, or they're paying gold sovereigns. For instance, Iran would get 20% of the global profits of Anglo-Persian, as British Petroleum was called. But the whole history from that period up until to the present day was where it started, where the companies would get the benefits, the primary benefits. Then as time would go on, the countries would assert more say and more control. In the late 1940s, in the early 50s, you had the 50-50, where the profits would really be split down the middle. And then by the 1970s, most of the profit was going to the country because it held the high card in the nationalist era, and the companies were becoming more like contractors until they were nationalized altogether. So it moved along a spectrum over a 40-year period.
From the perspective of oil, what did Saddam Hussein have to gain from invading Kuwait?
From the perspective of oil, what he had to gain was money and power. That he would have, I can't say with a stroke of a pen, but with the movement of his tanks, he would have doubled the oil resources of Iraq, made it an oil superpower almost the equal of Saudi Arabia. He would have had, with double the revenues, could have pursued a much more, even much bigger program of building up arms and weaponry and turning Iraq into a kind of a mini superpower. So the prize indeed for him, if he had pulled this off, was quite enormous and would have really changed the balance in the world. It's interesting, this whole episode started with two surprises. One was that Saddam Hussein had 100,000 troops on the border of Kuwait, and no one, including the Kuwaitis, thought they'd be used. The second surprise, and that was a surprise to us, the second surprise was this international coalition that President Bush put together. And I am sure, as you must be sure, that if Saddam Hussein had sat back and thought, my God, we're going to be quarantined like this, we're not going to get any hard currency revenues, instead of getting richer, we might get poorer, and I might even lose my job, that he would have certainly thought twice. He thought it was going to be a cakewalk.
Do you think that Saddam Hussein has any historical claim to the oil fields that he wants to get from Kuwait and the offshore islands?
Well, I think that the oil field, it's a contentious question. The Kuwaitis were taking what is a relatively minor amount of production out of it. I think the structure of an oil industry, the structure of an oil reservoir is a complex thing to map, and that you need to get this sort of oil engineers on both sides of petroleum engineers to get together and have some common reference to say, well, really, where is this oil? Where is it migrated? And as I understand, that hasn't been done. As to the islands, they had historically been Kuwaiti, but they were, you know, of strategic significance to Iraq, which has a relatively small seacoast. And so that from a strategic point of view, if Iraq could grab them, it would be to Iraq's advantage. The Kuwaitis didn't feel like giving up the territory. Maybe in retrospect, they would have. The ironic thing in this whole imbroglio is that Iraq was getting a lot of its objectives. In any event, in June and July, the wind was blowing from Baghdad and the other countries were falling in line. Oil prices were going up and Iraq was becoming known as the enforcer in OPEC. And people were really scared of Iraq, and he probably could have gotten that island and the oil field, whatever, the merits of the thing, if he had just kept the pressure up. And the rest of the world would never have learned to spell either the name of the island or of the oil field.
A lot of our involvement in the Gulf has to do with oil. What if Iraq invaded Kuwait and nobody did anything and things just played out from there? What effect do you think that would have had on oil?
Well, there was one theory that saying, well, he'd want to sell his oil anyway, and therefore it really wouldn't matter at all. I take a different view. I think it would have really changed the balance of power, and I think the other countries would have fallen in line, and Iraq and Saddam Hussein would dominate much of the world's oil and would use that to move on to positions of even greater power and influence. I mean, I don't think he was invading Kuwait just so he could be our larger oil merchant.
It must be very hard to predict the oil energy future right now. There's not only the Gulf crisis, but there's a lot of upheaval in the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union is one of the largest oil producers in the world.
The largest.
Okay, so and with the possibility of some of their republics seceding, I guess who can predict what the Soviet Union's oil future is going to be?
You know, it's one of these ironies of history are so, in a sense, delicious and interesting that 30 years ago, one of the great fears in Washington was of a Soviet oil exports going up and a Soviet economic offensive, exporting more oil and gaining political power. Now we'd be delighted to see the Soviet Union, or whatever it's going to be called in 5 years, exporting more oil. And we see the Soviet Union as the counterbalance to excessive dependence on the Persian Gulf. But in the meantime, of course, the Soviet Union is in chaos and disintegration, and Soviet oil production and exports are going down. And yet, looking towards the end of the 1990s, if you did a poll of oil companies, you said, where do you want to be at the end of the 1990s? What oil play do you want to be in? They'd say, one of the best bets around is the Soviet Union, and we hope we'll be able to be exploring there. And the Soviets, whose own oil industry is in a deplorable condition, are actively wooing these capitalist companies to come in and spend money and apply their technology. So history really does get turned around.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us about oil. Thank you.
Thank you.
And my guest has been Daniel Yergin, and he's the president of Cambridge Energy Research Associates, which is an international energy consulting firm, and is the author of a new history of oil, and it's called The Prize, The Epic Quest for Oil, Money, and Power.